Craig DiMartino was a professional rock climber who nearly lost his life in an accident 17 years ago. He accidentally dropped 30 metres from a rock ledge, the height of a 10-storey building. Landing on his feet, Craig had compound fractures of both legs and ankles and a broken back, neck, ribs and shoulder. Months in hospital and rehab followed, and eventually 18 months later, he decided to amputate his leg below the knee in order to be able to return to climbing. Since then, Craig has notched up a number of records, including the first amputee ascent of Yosemite's El Capitan in under 24 hours. But his focus now is very much on inspiring others with physical disabilities to get active again and to live with their trauma in a different way. His book about his journey is called After the Fall and is the subject of a recent short film called Craig's Reaction. We have a link to the trailer on our webpage, plus a fantastic gallery of Craig climbing. He really is a force of nature. And Craig DiMartino tells me how his love of climbing began.
You know, oddly enough, I went to a bachelor party right out of high school. One of my really great friends was getting married, and he kind of said to the group of us, hey, instead of going to the regular strip club, we're going to go rock climbing. And, you know, I had heard of it. I had maybe seen it on TV. Never had done it, and we went climbing that day, that afternoon, and it was just immediately something that resonated with me on just like lots of different levels. I just instantly fell in love with the movement and the location and just the whole thing that it brought to my life.
How did you grow your skill set and experience? What were you doing as a young climber?
I started kind of climbing with people who could kind of teach me the ropes. I didn't know a lot. I actually didn't even know what I didn't know. And so I was fortunate enough to have folks take interest when they saw my interest in climbing. And that kind of helped me refine how I could climb safely and how I could climb, you know, on a regular basis without getting hurt. And that kind of just fueled that love of just being outside climbing all the time.
What was your climbing life then by the time you got the whole adult gig, you'd had kids? How were you making climbing work and where was it taking you?
Climbing was always, pretty much from that bachelor party on, it was always just a huge part of my life. And I met my wife in a climbing gym. We had kids and they were little, very young climbers. And we just kind of made it fit around our family. Cindy, my wife, and I always were climbing together. And so when we had the kids when they were really young, we would just kind of take turns, or we would go with other people who had, you know, young families as well. And that way we could still do the climbing thing and enjoy climbing, but still also have the family time that we wanted to have as well.
This day where things changed, 2002, was it just a standard climbing day with a good mate?
Yeah, it was really a normal day. I was going with a great friend of mine. His name was Steve, and we were going to go up into Rocky Mountain National Park, and he and I had been kind of climbing on and off that whole summer of 2002, and just we were kind of picking routes that we both liked and had heard about, and so that day was no different. We just particular area called Sundance Buttress, and we had a couple different climbs in our sights that day, but then just as luck would have it, we kind of decided to go to this one in particular called White Man, where things kind of did end up changing for the very dramatic worst side.
What happened?
We started up basically in climbing. One person has to go first. That's the leader. And that particular climb, that was going to be my job. And so Steve and I kind of roped up. I started up the climb, and they divide climbs into pitches, which is basically a rope length. And so at the top of that first rope length, it took me roughly 20 minutes to climb that rope length. And when I got up to the anchor, Steve and I had talked about doing something that climbers call top roping. So once that first climber goes, he's then lowered to the ground, and then you're belaying from the ground as opposed to belaying from the ledge where you climb to. And Steve and I were both very experienced climbers at that time, and so it never really dawned on me to ask for any clarification of what he thought that meant. And so when I got to that anchor that was 100 feet off the ground, I kind of clipped in directly and then was being ready to be lowered back to the ground to Steve. But he misunderstood what I wanted to happen, and I accidentally got dropped from that ledge. So from the height of 100 feet, which is roughly a 10-story office building, I fell backwards. And so when I started to fall, I started to accelerate really quickly, and my first thought was that maybe there was just a bunch of slack in the system and that the rope would come tight eventually. And when that didn't happen, I realized I was picking up more and more speed. And so my reaction was to push on the cliff because I didn't want to scrape into the cliff, and I wanted to kind of see where I was falling to. And what that did was it did get me away so I could see down the cliff, but it also kind of tipped me horizontally. So as I was falling, I was falling in a horizontal orientation to the ground. And about 20 feet from the ground, there was a kind of a dead tree leaning against the cliff that when Steve and I started up the climb, I actually walked around that tree to get onto the cliff. I clipped the tree with my head, and that stood me back up into a standing orientation. So when I actually hit the ground, I was standing kind of perfectly upright. And from that kind of a distance, falling that fast, that's probably one of the only ways you can actually survive. And what it does is it actually sends the shockwave right up through your body. So when I hit the ground, both my legs exploded, basically. And I had compound fractures of my tibia and fibula on both legs. The shockwave kind of traveled up my body and broke my back at L2, which is right through your belly button, broke the ribs on my right side, cut up my shoulder and tore the labrum in my shoulder, and then broke my neck at C5, C6. And then I just crumpled down really onto the big blocks at the base of the climb, and that's where I laid for the next few hours.
You remember everything.
I do. I remember everything with the exception of hitting the ground. I remember leaving the anchor. I remember the fall. And then my next recollection is looking up at the cliff, and Steve was in my peripheral vision yelling at me. And I had just hit the ground, and I think our mind kind of blanks that piece out, which is something I'm very happy about. But that my next recollection is looking up, hearing him yelling.
How does rehabilitation even begin with the shattered, literally shattered body you've just described? What were those early hours and days involving?
It's crazy. When I, you know, it took them about 7 hours to get me out. You know, they got me on a litter, got me to a helicopter. The helicopter took me to the hospital, and then they began that long process of how do you rebuild this body. And initially, it was just them saying, he's not even going to live more than an hour. That's what they told my wife when she got to the hospital. And that kind of evolved into, okay, we're going to fuse his back. So at that back where I broke, they had to kind of remove. I didn't even have L2 anymore. I hit so hard, it actually just disintegrated. And so they have to rebuild that, and then they fused it together. So I'm fused for four levels in my lumbar spine. And then my neck ended up getting fused at C5, C6. And then the foot injuries were so, so deep that they did as much as they could, and they bandaged them. And because I had lost so much blood, they just figured, we'll see if he lives through the night, and then we'll kind of make a plan. And put me on a ventilator. I couldn't breathe, and moved me through intensive care for that evening just to kind of see what happened. And once I kind of got over that first hurdle of that first night, that first 24 hours, then they start to kind of like slowly piece things back together. And so I stayed in intensive care for 5 days, and then they moved me to an orthopedic care area where they could do surgeries. We kind of did a surgery every other day where they would go in and work on my feet, where they would sort of like take all the bone fragments out, they would clean everything up, and then they would make a plan for the next surgery. And that kind of did that for 2 weeks. We did that over and over and over. Once we got to that kind of 2 week window, they moved me to like a long care facility where they're just waiting kind of to see how you do. I hadn't yet walked at all. I couldn't bear anything. So you're in a wheelchair. You're just kind of trying to decide, like, what is happening to me at this present moment? You have no clue, and you're just living minute to minute, and some days, you know, second to second while they slowly rebuild you.
I'm wondering if that was almost protective, because you couldn't sit back and see the whole picture of what had happened to you. Was that just going with the plan in the early stages mentally almost a protection? I mean, can you even, how can you describe your mental state?
You know, you can't, that's a great question, because you don't really have the whole picture. You have very small windows of the picture. And even my wife would only tell me, you know, pieces of things, because you're already so mentally taxed. You can't really take on much more. And so Cindy would kind of tell me, okay, they're going to work on this, they're going to do this. And that's really all I needed to hear. I think if I had known the big picture, because the big picture at that point was they were telling her he's paralyzed because his spine was and back were broken so badly. So he's probably paralyzed. He just doesn't know it yet. I have very, very, because of the spinal cord injuries that I have, I have very spotty feeling from the waist down on kind of half my body. And so, you know, they were just assuming he's not going to be able to walk anymore, but we're not going to tell him any of that stuff. So you don't know the big picture. You don't really want to know the big picture. And for me, it was, I'm very task oriented. So as long as they were giving me a task, like, you're going to do this, this, and this. And those are simple tasks. Like, we're talking like, you're going to try to sit up today, and that's it. As long as I have those things laid out, then I'm much better. But if I had known the bigger picture, I think it would have killed me at that time.
What about the pain?
Crazy. I mean, just insane amounts of pain. Just where you keep thinking it's going to give up a little bit, and it really doesn't. And they do a great job with, like, keeping you kind of in a fog, but, you know, even that fog parts every now and again, and you remember just how bad it is. And so that first, I would even say the first month, you're just in this cycle of pain management, just trying to, like, keep your wits about you as much as you possibly can through those huge windows of pain.
At what point did you have to confront what to do with the leg and whether to amputate below the knee?
I actually went home. They kept me, I was in the hospital about 3 months, and then went home, and I had my leg, my right leg was in a cast still, and I had probably 11 screws and 2 plates in there still. And they kind of said, you know, we've done as much as we can with that leg. We'll just see if it heals over time. And so about 12 months went by, actually. So the next year I was walking in that cast and just trying to get it to heal and trying to help it to not hurt so badly. And it just got to a point where it wasn't going to heal anymore. And the doctor said, you know, we can't do any more surgeries. It's kind of up to you now if you want to keep it or if you don't want to keep it. It's your call. And so I kind of did some research, quite a bit of research, talking with folks who had amputated and who were active again, because in the back of my mind, I was still thinking, you know, I want to go back to climbing in some form. I don't know what that's going to be, but with a leg and a cast, that's not something I can do. And I wanted that quality of life back. I didn't have that quality of life at the time. And so amputation was kind of the window to go back to that quality of life I had prior to the accident. And so 18 months after the accident, I went back in, to amputate my leg below the knee to get that quality of life back.
This mental journey and the prospects for recovery, I imagine, is a very important part of anybody's story and a part of the story of the people you work with in trying to encourage them back into their sport. Because I can see how getting back to something you love is tremendously empowering and can help. I want to talk in a moment about depression and whether you experienced it. But on the other side of the coin, is there not a human instinct that says, no way are you going back to the sport where this happened? what was the sort of the mental juggle going on?
The juggle was one of, you know, here's this thing that I loved that I had kind of built my life around, and then all of a sudden almost kills me and basically has turned me into this person that I never thought I would be. You know, here I am, this fully disabled person now, by the textbook definition. And so deciding in my mind to go back to that is a really strange leap, but it's also a leap, like, I felt like if I didn't even if I didn't try it in some form, then I would just be kind of cheating myself. And so I felt like I'm just going to try it with no expectation. If I still like it, then great. But if I can't deal with it at all, then I'll walk away from it. And that's okay, too. And Cindy and I spoke at length about this, you know, because her being a longtime climber as well, she understood that struggle. But I think me just understanding that I'm going to go at this with no expectation, and I'm going to see where it goes, was probably the healthiest thing I could do, because you don't, if I had gone into it thinking, okay, I want to be like I was before, that person, for all intents and purposes, that person is dead and gone. And I think I understood that, okay, I am not that person anymore. So now what is my new normal and how do I pursue that?
So that's really a healthy way of approaching it, without expectations, without the pressure of saying, I have to get this back. Did you go through periods of what you would describe as depression? And second to that, is that common with some of the people who you now help? Is it part of the story?
Yeah, that is part of, I think, anyone's journey in this kind of heavy trauma. For me, it was that going home and you see yourself in the mirror for the first time, where you're missing your leg and you have all these scars, and your body does not, it just doesn't work the way it used to. And that is a really tough thing to come to grips with, because you have to be able to look at yourself and say, okay, I can still do what I want to do. I have to do it differently now. And for me, that was a bit of a struggle, because, you know, I was very used to climbing and moving and just doing the things I did without thinking. It was just easy to do. And now you're talking just walking and standing up and getting down and moving were challenging some days. And so that mental struggle is, you know, 'cause I have, you know, it's been 15 years and I'm still, you know, I have a lot of chronic pain issues because of all the things I broke and damaged. And so you're always in this bit of down where you're kind of, the pain can kind of grind on you. And so you have to be able to compartmentalize that stuff and say, okay, it is uncomfortable, it is bad, but it is a fluid situation that is changing always, for the good or the worse. It is always changing. And so once I understood that, that was able to kind of keep me present and keep me moving forward.
So there's definitely a strategy needed for pain management. It's not suddenly going to be behind you, or I imagine behind many of the people that you now help and work with. What was the first outing back?
Oh, it was positively terrifying. It was, you know, going out with my wife, with some friends, and just, I was certain that I was going to just fall again and get hurt. You know, the biggest thing, and I see this in all the adaptive athletes I work with now, is when you're fresh out of trauma, your biggest concern is being hurt again. You will do anything you can to avoid being hurt again. And I was right there. I was certain I was going to get hurt. I was certain I was going to get dropped. Of course, that didn't happen. But then you have to kind of overcome that, and that only happens by doing it over and over and over. So, you know, the first time out was terrifying. The second time out was terrifying, but not quite as terrifying. And so just, you know, you're doing it over and over, and your brain is kind of desensitizing to it. And that fear can be controlled somewhat. It is just a long process of just over and over to kind of wear it down.
Long and also important, because the fear, while completely understandable and about avoiding you having an accident on top of an accident, can it inhibit aspects of climbing? And how did you manage with this, you know, a bit forward and a bit back and a bit forward and a bit back, to get to the point where you could take on more and not be inhibited by the fear?
I think because I was doing it, you know, again, with that no expectation, I was able to kind of explore, okay, what does my body actually do now? Like, what is something that I can focus on? And I would focus on these really small, attainable goals. And those goals would just be like, I'm going to climb 40 feet today and that's it. And, you know, that would be a huge day for me after I first came back. And that, once, you know, you get that low hanging fruit and you're kind of having some success, that fuels more success in your mind. And so for me, it was like, okay, I'm going to do these little climbs and just kind of try to control that fear and try to knock it down to a manageable level. And that kind of just kept propelling me forward. And for me, as long as I was kind of moving, and it made me feel better. It made my back feel better. It made a lot of the joint issues I have feel better. So it was kind of like evolving into this package that I wanted that I just didn't know I wanted. I thought I wanted this quality of life that I had before. But I probably would have been hard-pressed to actually quantify what that was. Whereas now, as I was out, I was just so happy to be out with my wife and kids and friends that that quality of life was kind of revealing itself slowly to me. And that was what I actually craved. And so I wanted that again. And it was, over time, was kind of becoming more apparent to me, this is what it's going to look like.
What is the process of adapting your climbing, your techniques, your balance? You've got to relearn climbing as a sport. And what were the stages or the things you had to learn as that happened?
The biggest thing, and you hit it perfectly, is the balance. Is all of a sudden, you know, climbing is a very balance-oriented sport. And so when you lop off a very large part of your body, that center of balance is gone, and you have to relearn it, where it is and how it works. And so once I could kind of figure that out and figure out, like, okay, with a fused back and neck, I have to move a particular way. With an amputated leg, I have to move a particular way. Once I kind of got those things sorted a bit, then I had to deal with the prosthetic foot. At the time, there were no prosthetic climbing feet made. It was something that I made with a friend of mine who makes my legs in Windsor, Colorado, here in the U.S. And I said to him, I want to climb again, but I can't climb with like a regular prosthetic foot. So how can we make something? And so we literally cobbled something together from a drawing on a napkin that we thought would work. And that foot ended up working for me for about 3 years. Actually, I climbed on that foot, and we kind of kept refining the shape and the size, and that kind of steered me into this area where I could then kind of up my climbing game. It made me able to climb better, you know, harder routes, and it made me kind of begin to set higher goals for myself as far as climbing goes.
Okay, so getting back climbing is one thing. And as you mentioned, you now were getting different things out of it or wanting different things out of it. But that doesn't stop you taking on some very big challenges. Becoming the first disabled person to climb El Capitan in a day. How quickly or slowly did we get to this scale of ambition? How did you go about planning it?
So it was a slow process. I started climbing probably 6 months after my amputation, and then I went to Yosemite the first time probably 4 years after the accident. And so it was one of those, like, it was a slow ramp up where I thought, okay, this is, you know, if I could go and repeat these routes in these areas, where would I go and do that? And El Cap was really high on my list of things, but I kind of thought there's no way I'm going to have that fitness level to be able to do it. But then it slowly evolved into the fitness level kind of came back. And so I contacted a friend of mine in Yosemite Valley, and he and I kind of made a plan. And, you know, going into it, I thought, I didn't think it was the smartest idea. I'll be totally honest. I thought I have a really good chance of getting really injured again, or, you know, people die on these climbs. And so trying to come to terms with that in my mind was a bit of a hassle for me as far as like planning goes, because you're constantly going down that rabbit hole. But I think once I committed to it and trained, I felt great going into it. And that just kind of then set me up for being able to do other things on that same scale, but then just in different ways and in different venues.
14 hours. That's not enough. you want to go back with a team, an all-disabled team, to complete El Cap. And I'm wondering if this is where the old you had come back to meld itself with the new normal that you were talking about. It was almost not only that your body was being rebuilt, but so were you, and you were letting some ambition back in there again. Is that how it happened?
That's exactly how it happened, because, you know, when you go in and you're just ticking off low-hanging fruit, the ambition level doesn't have to be that high. I mean, it can be pretty low and you're still going to have some success. Whereas once I climbed El Cap in a day again, actually for the first time, when I was able-bodied, I'd never climbed it in a day. It was something that I thought I would like to try, but I didn't think I would be able to do. And so then when I did it in a day as an adaptive athlete, I thought, oh man, I mean, if we did that, like, I wonder what else we could actually pull off. And so started talking with some friends who I think are equally as delusional as myself, and they were easy to be talked into it. And so they thought it was a great idea, and we just went back and sailed on it the first time, and then went back the next season and were ultimately successful with two of my friends, Jerem Fry and Pete Davis, which just was just such a neat thing for me to see that kind of come full circle.
What have you learned from working with others? All sorts of different personalities, people with different levels of risk in mind, people motivated by different things, people coping differently mentally with their disability. What have you learned from working with them all about getting them back into this activity?
I think that the neatest thing for me, you know, I came back after I had a lot of great success in my own goals with climbing, and I thought about how do I use that for something better than just me being a better climber. And I kind of tapped into this adaptive teaching and kind of exposing people who had gone through heavy trauma to climbing in the way that I used it for recovery. And so it's been this great thing where I can work with these people who, like you said, they're coming at it from all different ways. You know, some are doing really well, some are doing very poorly. But for me, what I do is the commonality is me saying, I understand this heavy trauma happened, however it happened. You were either, you know, it's an accident, or it's a birth thing that you've had your whole life, or it's something that is happening to you today as something that you, with your nervous system shutting down. That trauma is there, and I understand that. But how do you move forward, and how do you still have this full life? I did it with climbing, and so I exposed them to climbing in the way that I used it in my recovery process, and that is for goal setting, that is for perspective, and that is for a way to keep moving instead of just sitting still and waiting for something else bad to happen. You have to kind of be moving forward, and if you're moving in any fashion, then you are moving away from that traumatic event. So whatever that is, you are actually moving away, which is always positive. So even if you're getting beat up climbing and you're having a crappy day, you're still actually climbing and you're still doing something that is in your control. And for me, the accident was this amazing lesson in I don't have as much control as I probably thought I did in my life. And I think that that is a really hard pill to swallow for people, to realize that, man, I'm really not that much in control. You know, you realize there's these things happen to people all the time. So now all of a sudden, here is something you can do that's really simple. This climbing thing that I'm speaking about is a very simple thing. It's a wonderful activity, but it's very simple that you can use in your everyday life in this new normal to actually progress and move forward. And that's going to move further from that trauma.
Craig DiMartino.